Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 190 for Spring Semester 2024. Today, the capital asset pricing model. This one is considered in some ways the triumph of finance. And if you are thinking of getting a tattoo, you can't go wrong with getting the Cap M tattooed on your side or your thigh or something like that, because it is a sign that you really have crossed over into finance. And I'll say more about it after a bit here and go through the last part of risk and return. On Wednesday, you will have a surprise quiz, so please be surprised by it. It will primarily cover bonds and those kinds of subjects, but it will cross into a little bit of the first lecture in risk and return as well. It won't be a terrible kind of quiz, but do make sure that you are able to use that template that I gave you for finding bond prices and bond yields. As I said, that is the important mathematical things that you should be able to do out of that chapter on bonds. And of course, there's qualitative stuff too. A quick look at the numbers, though. And as you can see, this is a bear day trying to find some reason not to be. You see that we opened down, and even after the opening, it still dropped. If you can see those spark charts, you can see that it dropped after the bell. At the bell, it was already down, and it kept going down for about, I think it was about 10 minutes, and then it's been sort of jagged, trying to grovel its way back up from that immediate loss that happened. And it's really just a malaise in the market right now. Some negative sentiment is in there. It's nothing massive, nothing major, no apocalypse. But the traders are a little on the sour side. And we can talk more about that here in a little bit when I get back into risk and return. Now, crude oil, as I had said, it's got a new trading range from about 81 or about 81 up to 87, 88, somewhere in there, maybe 89. But it's on the downside of that, and it broke down below the base of that, and then of that new trading range, and then it quickly recovered from there, although it's still not particularly dramatic. We're up there just above 81, working our way up to 82, but it's nothing terrible or tragic. And as you could probably have noticed, the price of gasoline, as I said, has already reflected this new higher trading range we're seeing at the pumps around here, about $3.79 for the regular unleaded. Nothing catastrophic, of course, but it's up there a little bit. Now, interestingly, gold is pushing the next neckline it has at $2,200 an ounce. It's on an upswing, and it's just that there are some who are moving their money out of other assets and getting them into some gold right now. I wouldn't call it a flight to quality so much. You see, the bond market over here, we have the bond yields pulling upward, and that would mean prices are falling, there is selling of bonds, and there is selling of stocks as well. So that would probably indicate that there is a modest flight to quality, from stocks to bonds, from bonds to gold. You're seeing that second stage of a flight to quality, but it is certainly nothing catastrophic happening right now. If I am reading the markets, however, there is globally, at least in the first world countries, there is a movement to trim yields. The yields seem to be starting to fall on the around the mark around the world right now. I mean now, as in this minute. So this may turn on a dime, and these yields may start to drop as investors move money out of gold, out of money markets, and buy into the bond market. You do see some. I can't really see from this bar chart. And let me click on this, see if I can see it in. Yeah, you see that top out right there? That may be the first indication that the U.S. Treasuries are going to follow the government instrument, debt instruments in other countries, and start to tail downward here over the next couple of hours. Hard to say, though, but it does look like there is a little bit of movement that we've hit our top there on the yields. Okay, now going on here. Nikkei started out down, started crabbing, and then it sort of floated below its opening. And then right at the close, it really started to take a dump. It was down a total of 1.16% for the day. That last little thing there, that was the bears coming in right at the end of the day in Tokyo last night here and taking a real shot at it. Now, London, it started falling. It just started dropping, but right about midday, it started to turn back up, like our markets are. Now, they're not finished for the day yet in London, as I've said. They've still got an hour or so left, I think, on their trading. But it's noticeable that they are in a recovery. The FTSE 100 is. And, well, it's kind of hard to say. We were in a recovery, and now it's turning back down the other way. Just a lot of bad sentiment going on right now. It's not horrible, but it's just a grouchy day today. Let me take you on a journey here for just a little bit. And this is, for the most part, it's terminology. And then it turns into something more. And as I had said, yeah, that's what I want. Now, the measures of risk. There, of course, is the standard deviation, which is 1 over for a sample. And 1 over n minus 1 times the sum from I equals 1 to n of the each data point minus the average squared. Now that squared, let me say something about that. You may have already heard this before. Why do we square that? And then take the square root of everything after, oops, and which I didn't do there. So let me get that done here. Square root. Why do we square it and then take the square root? It's simple, because some data points are going to be below the average and some are going to be above the average. If we don't square it, then those below and above will cancel each other out and we will not see what really happened as far as volatility both ways go. So we square them so that they're all positive, and then we correct it after we've added them all up by taking the square root. And that, of course, is our overall way of determining risk. Now, this standard deviation, sigma, or in more technical terms, we call it S. We reserve sigma for the population, but one way or the other. This is actually the one that is used in corporate finance. If you took a course from me, for example, in corporate finance, where I'm looking at variation in revenues or variations in costs, the risks inherent in your fixed costs, the risks inherent in your variable costs, the risks inherent in your profit and all of that, we use this animal right here to do that. More specifically, we probably use the coefficient of variation. The coefficient of variation, CV, is the standard deviation divided by the average, which takes away the scale, the size of the numbers, so that we can compare, for example, fixed costs might be very large compared to variable costs, or vice versa. When you use a CV, it corrects for those differences in size, so you get a pure measure of the relative risk levels of the different lines on your accounting statement or on your managerial accounting sheets. That's all that is. And it's very useful. Even for us, it's useful too. But our big 800-pound gorilla is always beta. Now, the beta, I'm going to write this down, and I want to talk about this a little later, and I'll show you where you could actually do this. The beta, let's say, of a stock is the Pearson correlation coefficient of that stock with the market portfolio times the standard deviation of the stock over the standard deviation of the market portfolio. That's how we get betas. And you can calculate them. They're not that hard to calculate. Now, yours would probably be off a little bit, or maybe a little more than a little bit, because technically, and I said this the last time in last Wednesday's lecture, the beta, you're supposed to use expected returns and expected standard deviations. But mostly we would be working with historical data. So there would be a difference between what you see and what some big reporting service would show, because it could do the crunching to get expected numbers instead of from the historical numbers. Anyway, that one's there too. Another measure of risk, and I kind of dismiss this one, but it does have a useful part to it. The Sharpe ratio, which is the return to your stock or portfolio minus the risk-free rate over the standard deviation. And in fact, I've got a sheet that you'll be able to pull up later, a risk and return sheet, where it will do the Sharpe ratio. It's just one of the calculations that it does when you put in data. Now, the Sharpe ratio, as I said, okay, here's the big criticism of Sharpe. Sharpe uses a standard deviation as the metric of beta of risk instead of beta as a metric of risk. I don't know. It's just been around forever, and it's almost always, if you look at a mutual fund, they'll report the Sharpe ratio. It's easier to find the Sharpe ratio in the reporting than it is the beta sometimes. It's a number, and it's kind of a big thing here. Let me show you something here. Now, there's something that's on the side here, and I can turn, let me turn up these lights so you can see a little better in here. But R minus R sub F. The book, later it says it the way I say it, but at first they call this the risk premium. The risk premium. Later, technically, what we call this is the market premium over risk-free. Right. You'll hear me call it the market premium. The market premium over the risk-free rate. And you would do this for a stock. Like that. Here's what it's telling you. You can go risk-free anytime you want. You look like a very timid, fearful investor, a man who would never take a chance on anything. When they say, would you like to have cornflakes or grape nuts, you say, I don't want to get it over my head, I'll have the cornflakes. Okay?
Okay.
You're the guy who drives at 25 miles an hour on the Autobahn as cars try to go around you and they take off the sides of your car and their wind shear. Okay. You're the guy who did not want to go to college because you could go right out and get a job at $8 an hour. No risk of college for you. But if you had gone to college, you would have made $50 an hour. So there's a risk premium that you would realize by bearing risk instead of bearing no risk. So in other words, this animal right here, and would be, if I write it this way, R sub M minus R sub F. This is the market premium. That's the market premium. So in other words, we expect the return to the market this year to be 16%, and the risk-free rate is 4%, then the market premium over risk-free is going to be 12%. This is your reward for bearing the risk of the market portfolio. This is your reward for bearing the risk of the market portfolio. And that is hugely important to us. Because if you take beta of a stock times R sub M minus R sub F, beta is what magnifies or demagnifies the market premium that you will realize. So in other words, if I took a beta, let's take a couple. Let's say beta 1 is 1.00. That would mean that you would have 1.00 times 16% minus 4%. So you would earn exactly your premium for the risk that you took at a 1.00 beta would be exactly the market return. If, however, let's say that you decided that you were going to take 1.5 beta, then you would have 1.50 times 16% minus 4%, which would be 18%. That would be what you would earn because the beta has magnified the market premium. Suppose instead that you took a beta of 0.5. That would mean would be 6%. You take half of the market risk, you get half of the market's reward. Now, one special one here. Suppose that you did not want to take any risk, beta 4. I'm sorry, I'm writing these all over the board here. these tiny little boards they have here, beta sub 4 is 0.00. In other words, you want something that has no beta risk. Well, in that case, you would have 0.00 times 16% minus 4%. You would get no reward for bearing any of the market risk. Now, that doesn't mean you won't get a reward. That's where CAPM comes in. But as far as market-driven risk, you get none. That's all the beta is. Beta is nothing but a magnifier or demagnifier on the market premium. Beta is nothing but a magnifier or a demagnifier on the market premium. See, the market premium is 12%. Beta is going to either magnify it or demagnify it. That's all beta does. But this is driven by the market's conditions. So as the expected return to the market portfolio changes, or as the risk-free rate changes, then this magnification or demagnification is on a different number. Let me take this off the board here, just to put it together. We start with a premise here. No investment would give you less than the risk-free rate. Because suppose I'm going to give you an investment, sir, that is risky as hell. But you could, and you will earn just what you would get on a treasury bill that has no risk. Well, you'll say, kiss my ass. I'm not going to do that. I'll just take the treasury bill. Okay? I can give you $10 to walk out that door on the first floor, or I can give you $10 to jump off the fourth floor balcony outside there. Either way, you get $10. Which one are you going to take?
You know, it's a gloomy morning. Maybe I'll do the roof.
Yeah, and then he can sue the school.
No, because he'll be sued by the squirrel he lands on, those fat-ass squirrels out there. Damn beggars walk up to you. Can I please have something, sir? Get away from me, you fat-ass squirrel. Anyway, but what I'm trying to get to here is that there's not going to be, in a reasonable world, any investment that would pay you below the risk-free rate. And so we could say, well, what would that mean for the expected return to a stock? Well, the first thing it would mean is that you would earn the risk-free rate. You would earn it. Because no investment is going to give you less than that. Because you would just go over and buy treasuries if that happened. And then in addition to that, you will get the market premium times the magnifier, the beta. That mother right there is called the capital asset pricing model. The capital asset pricing model, the CAPM. This is what I was telling you about at the beginning. If you're going to get a tattoo, you cannot get wrong with this one. Large font, Times New Roman, maybe, just for the tastefulness of it. There you go. That is this. Now, a little bit of a historical background on this, just to make sure you know where we are. There are competing models. There's one called APT, the arbitrage pricing model. It's basically this one, but it says that there are different betas attached to an investment. And you would have to add in, and I'm going to just write this here, like this one might be the traditional beta, and then there might be another beta times market premium, and there might be another beta times the market premium. There might be a whole series of them. That's APT, arbitrage pricing model. But you know what? Many studies have been done, and most of them find out that worrying about these other weird-ass betas, they don't do any better predicting return than the classic CAPM does. They really don't. Now, we're always looking for a better way, because CAPM isn't perfect, obviously. The expected return you calculate and what actually happens, you know, it can deviate. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute, that it's a very cool place to look. But realistically speaking, this works. And in fact, interestingly enough, well, let me go into this. I'll go into this. Graphically, if I were to use this as the y and the beta as the x, so on the horizontal axis we have beta, on the vertical axis we have the expected return. Well, the first thing we would know, let's say one. Six, seven, eight, nine. So if on this axis, here's 1.00 for beta, I'm doing 0.2 increments here, then we would know that a beta of 1 will yield the expected return to the market portfolio. Well, that's what beta of 1 means. That's why we call it beta of 1. We also know that a beta of 0 would get us the risk-free rate, R sub F. If it's a risk-free instrument, then we expect it to pay the risk-free rate. Now, if you remember from your linear algebra, 2 points create a line. This is the CAPM graphically, beta plotted against expected return. We call this line the securities market line. And it's just a plot. So I could say, well, what would be a beta of 0.6? That's right here, should be there. Beta of 1.5 should be right here. It's just a visual representation of CAPM. But it has some interesting uses. First things first. And this is my traditional rant from hell. We even have a contest we did. I don't know if they're still running it. But you see all of these talking heads. Well, this fund manager got the highest return this year. Boy, that guy is a real excellent son of a bitch. Yes, indeed. We give out awards. There are contests all over the country. And we had one here. The team that gets the highest return wins. It's two-dimensional. They completely ignore what risk was taken. Yeah, I can be a hero. I can get a damn return clear up here about where Jesus lives. But you are going to take a massive risk to do that. Appropriateness of investment. You're sure you can be, as a matter of fact, this was 341, maybe about 6 years ago. I had teens make portfolios, and I said, okay, choose wisely and get it done. Great, get a good return on it. And I told them what I would expect them to get based upon CAPM. Report CAPM, report what the expected return is, and then at the end of the semester, report what your return is. Okay, so in other words, you got to hit CAPM. Well, this one group, they came in about 2 weeks before the end of the semester, and they'd been working. Their beta was all over the place. They were adding things, pulling things out, and I couldn't even figure out where the hell it was, the beta, but their return was negative 7%. And they said, so basically we're screwed. And I said, what do you do? Have any of you ever, old college football term, have any of you ever heard of the Hail Mary in football? You're clear back near your own goal line, and the Hail Mary is that pass clear down the field, fourth and 15, and you've just, Hail Mary, just throw it clear down the field and hope one of your guys catches it down there. Said you can do a Hail Mary. Liquidate the portfolio and just throw it into the highest beta thing you can find. Because, I mean, theoretically, you put a beta out there, at least 2 weeks, you're going to have a return up there, maybe. Well, I'll be darned if they did, and they came out pretty well. I mean, of course, that was also a portfolio that could have crashed and burned them so that they would have not passed my course. As a matter of fact, they probably couldn't have gotten a job at Ace Trucking, gotten a scholarship at Ace Trucking School. Okay. But yeah, you can, I mean, all this is doing is telling you, look, what do you expect to return based upon the beta? But that's the important thing, is that there's no such thing as an expected return or a return to a portfolio. It is always attached to a risk variable somewhere in there. But here's the interesting thing. Actual analysis puts the portfolios, the real portfolios, all around it. Now, we have some anomalous portfolios. It's more like, the real world doesn't lie on a perfect line. It lies on a scatter plot. So the world doesn't really, oh God, this is a CAPM. We better get these returns right there. No, it'll be around that. Now, we do see a few anomalies. And it's the stuff of research papers and all of that. Like, for example, there's an anomaly called the January effect, where there are certain stocks, classes of stocks, that seem to violate CAPM. There's another one called a small cap phenomenon, where certain types of small capitalization stocks seem to come in above the securities market line. However, there's a more enduring phenomenon, and you might actually be part of that, not know it. See, most day traders and amateur investors lose money. In real terms, or in terms of opportunity cost of the time and capital they put into doing day trading, they lose it. But every now and then, we see a trader, we see someone who routinely gets a return above the securities market line. Of course, we see plenty of traders who are below it. You see, right here, this trader above, he is earning an abnormal return. And it's not just a one-off. This wasn't a one-trick pony. This one keeps staying above it. We have a name for this distance right here, from where Cap M says he should earn, or she, and where he or she does earn. We call that Jensen's alpha. Jensen's alpha. As a matter of fact, there's a famous and very good website called Seeking Alpha. Have any of you ever heard of it? What you're doing. It's a play for those who know what alpha is. Jensen's alpha. So, of course, trading houses are going to give free accounts because all we need to do is find you, Mr. Genius, and then we watch what you invest in, and then we front run you. You know what front running is?
You invest behind me.
No, in front of you. You say, I want to put in this trade for this stock, and a split second before we execute your trade, we execute ours for what you did. That's front running. It's illegal. Okay, but yeah, we're looking for the pause. We're seeking alphas.
Oh,
yeah.
How would you do that? How would you like do it a split second before?
I get yours, and you're gonna go. Okay, I gotta watch how I say this. You see, there used to be a system called SOES, Small Order Entry System, so that small orders got in first before large orders. It was just a NASDAQ thing. Okay, and they've changed it. It's got a different name now. I don't remember what the name is now. But that's still the way it is. So I, as an insider, in order to take advantage of this, I cannot put in a big block trade. What I'll do is I'll have 100, 1,000 phony shadow accounts. Each one will be a small order entry system. I just have those happen, and then a split second later, I execute your order. As a matter of fact, the algo is simply, okay, this is one of our alphas. This is an alpha trade, and so the alpha will electronically put in a mass order through that each one of them will be small, but they'll get through the SO system, and then yours will come in towards the back door of the other ones. They'll muscle you out of the way and get theirs in. You think it doesn't happen? It happens all the time. We're always looking for it. It was like up in Chicagoland. I took my students up to the White Sox so they could learn about finance at the White Sox and what they were. So they maybe get jobs or something like that. And we were hosted by the White Sox charitable organization. They spend a lot of money every summer setting up and funding Little League teams through Chicagoland. Hundreds and hundreds of Little League teams. Now, do you think that they do this out of the beneficence of their hearts? No. All it takes is finding one little snot-nosed kid, 9 years old, who's got an arm that just won't quit. Or one that knows how to hustle bases faster than anyone else. Or someone who just happens to be just unbelievable with that bat. 3, 4 of those out of 5,000, 10,000 kids. And you have won your investment. It's the same thing. It's the same idea. You're a charitable person, but you're always looking for that winner. And then you can milk that winner. You find that kid, you go to his family, we're going to take care of you now. We'll make sure you have a good place to live, you've got food on the table, and we're going to make sure that kid gets his schoolwork done. We'll have tutors, we'll do the whole damn 9 yards for that kid if you will sign us with an option for that kid down the road for us to get him into the farm league a little later. These are the kinds of things that happen, okay? And in trading, we are always seeking alphas. So, you hear about, well, he's an alpha male. No, we're looking for a completely different kind. We're looking for the nerd, the geek that just happens to have the magic. We don't know why they have it. Hell, they might use magic mushrooms. We don't care. But at the same time, we're always looking for those players, the ones that just seem to have a magic. I was at casinos back many, many, many years ago. There was, once in a while, you'd see some son of a bitch. He could not lose. And of course, I was getting poorer and poorer the more I paid, played on the 21 table or something like that. But that son of a bitch, he just kept winning. And it's a magic. But anyway, okay. So, that's an alpha. That's a positive. But don't get me wrong. This guy down here, that's a negative alpha. So we're always looking for the alpha. And as long as you stay at least alpha zero or a little bit above alpha zero, you are actually beating the market. The term beating the market is misused. Oh, he got higher than the market portfolio, so he beat the market. No, he just went out here. See, this is the return to the market portfolio. Sure, you can beat that by just taking a higher beta on your portfolio. But actually, beating the market portfolio really means at that level of beta of your portfolio, what did you do? Did you get above Cap M? Did you get a positive alpha? That is beating the market. One more thing about that. If I see one of you getting a positive alpha, I know it's genuine. And I also know that you probably won't do it again. If you do, I want to be your friend for life. But, I mean, a positive alpha for 1 year or for a couple of months, it usually vanishes. It's the enduring positive alpha that is a mark of a truly good small-time investor. When I see a large investor who's constantly getting a positive alpha, I smell a rat. I smell insider trading. That's all there is to it. Because the reality is that having a positive alpha, you either have to have a gift or you have to have some kind of insider information. That's just the reality of it. I'm not going to bullshit you about that. You hear someone, well, I beat the market every year. Okay, first of all, that means is that you took a high beta portfolio. No, it was at that beta. I got a positive alpha every year. Okay, exactly how are you doing this? Because the market, if I identify you, sir, as having a positive alpha year after year, I'm going to start trading in front of you. And I'll suck your profit away. You think the stock price is going to go up to $10? Well, I'll make sure I buy into it and drive it up to $10 before your order ever gets traded. So you will lose that gift because everyone will figure out what you're doing. And because you signal it when you do the buy order or the sell order. You're signaling to the market, here I am. And then everyone's going to come in there and take your mojo. Now, a couple of things here. First of all, the return to your portfolio. I mean, this is kind of like stupid pet trick stuff. Weight of portfolio of stock one times the return to stock one plus the weight of stock two times the return to stock two plus the weight of stock N times the return to stock N. Okay, it's nothing hard. You can just put it, the return to the portfolio is the sum from I equals 1 to N of the weights of the individual components times the return to the individual components. Just take the weight times the return, add them up, some product on Excel, and you're there. That's your dinner. Yeah.
So the big traders, like, for example, Nancy Pelosi, she'd be smart most years, she's
however
the biggest investor.
Well, let's get that one down. I saw some look at hers, but one of the things about that is that the betas are a little bit suspect. That those are high beta stocks. Another, a really great example was a former senator. Matter of fact, I think her niece is running for a congressional seat here in Illinois somewhere. But she was in the secret meetings before the COVID pandemic was known to the outside world, and she unquestionably traded on vaccine stocks. More importantly, her husband is the chairman and owner of the New York Stock Exchange. He did too. They are untouchable. There's no question that they were using secret information to trade in to take a profit, to make money off the pandemic. There were others. We count probably 5 representatives and 1 senator clearly. And of course, they're going to say, we don't control our portfolios. We have it all done through a blind trust and a portfolio manager. Well, they have something called a telephone. And they probably called the portfolio manager, said, get the hell into mRNA, Moderna, get the hell into Pfizer, PFE, get yourself into AstraZeneca, and get the hell out of this, 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 and this. That's all it takes. And of course, which is why I always thought I should run for a political position. I mean, I got the damn charm for it. But aside from that, yeah.
They can just do that, like everything that you just talked about. People were always watching people who were.
Yeah, and that's why you want to watch those sons of bitches as closely as you can. There are reporting services that report on insider trading. That's just the CEOs and the C-suite people doing buys and sells. Keeping an eye on those giant dogs like that, hard as hell, because they hide under privacy laws. They use private trusts, and you can't see it until their financial disclosures. And so by then, of course, it's too late to know what they're doing. We have some tricks in the book to watch.
So I should start an ETF that just tracks Nancy Pelosi.
Well, if you're obsessed with her, I mean, she's pretty old for a guy your age, but, you know, don't get into this obsession that it's one political party. The Republicans were the ones who played that game with the COVID virus. Only one Democrat, and he's a dumbass. But at the same time, and it's not just politicians, don't get me wrong, lot of the wealthiest people in the world. I mean, Elon Musk and his brother were insider trading. There's no question about it. They've been chased around and around by the SEC on their insider trading. They'll never burn them. Now, if you do it, Mr. Cousins, you will be caught and you will be made into some hard-timer's old lady with a full wedding ceremony for 10 years. Us at the bottom of the level, if we do anything wrong, even if we fart sideways out of our butts, we're nailed. The big dogs are hardly ever. Once in a while, they'll make an example of a whale. But for the reality of it, FINRA is for us little people. And that's just the reality of it. And they've had a FINRA representative here, and I cooked her on the Loeffler. And so I'm not invited to go to those again. But anyway, let me get on to something else here. Oh, by the way, the beta of a portfolio is the same thing. The beta of a portfolio is nothing but the sum from I equals 1 to N of the weight of each stock in the portfolio times the beta of that stock. You just take the weights times the beta and add them up. And that's an important one to know, because that gives you what the overall beta of your portfolio is. Now let me go back here, though, and talk about a lowly little animal called the Pearson correlation coefficient. You see, a stock has two kinds of risk, as I said. There is the total risk, is the diversifiable risk, the risk that can be removed through portfolio diversification, plus the non-diversifiable risk. Now, the non-diversifiable risk is beta. Your job is to make that diversifiable risk go away. And that is that risk pooling that I told you about on Wednesday. The more you put in, the more the kinks in each, the standalone risk goes away. So if you were to make your own portfolio, let me show you over here. Number of stocks on the horizontal axis and the total risk of the portfolio here. If you have one stock in a portfolio, you eat the risk of that stock, both the diversifiable and the non-diversifiable. I think I already said it. You buy Microsoft on its own, that beta represents only about 40% of what you're going to face as far as volatility goes. Buying single stock is insane. You're not going to get rewarded for something that you don't have to do. You're not going to get any reward at all. Only for the non-diversifiable risk. But as you put in more and more stocks into a portfolio, the diversifiable risk component goes away, and you asymptotically approach the non-diversifiable risk. How many does it take? 95% of the diversifiable risk will be gone with about 35 stocks. That's a bad thing, though, because you have to manage a 35-stock portfolio. That's expensive, and it's time-consuming because you've got to be constantly balancing the portfolio. Or you could buy an ETF, the SPDR, the S&P 500 SPDR. SPY. That son of a bitch has 500 stocks, and you buy one share of that, and you have the portfolio diversification of the S&P 500. In fact, it is so well diversified that we use it as a proxy for the market portfolio because it's got so many stocks in it. But here's the thing. Suppose that you want to build a portfolio and you... I'm not going to buy 35 stocks. What you need to do is find stocks that have low correlation against each other so that when one's going up, the other's going down, and they are canceling out each other's standalone risk. So how do we do that? How do we find those? Well, there's a wonderful place called the Portfolio Visualizer. I can type in stocks and see what their correlation coefficients are. So let me do that right now. Let's try Walmart, WMT, put a space. Oh, I don't know. Meta. Is Meta M-E-T-E? I think it is. It'll tell me if I'm wrong. Let's try General Motors, Tesla. Pfizer. Give me some guidance here. What else? Apple? Oh, AAPL. Lockheed Martin.
MasterCard.
What?
MasterCard. MA.
MA? Is it MA? Okay. Let's do these. Now you can leave these alone. You can be a little fancier if you want. Now what you get is a correlation matrix. Now you may have... Did they show... Well, I keep forgetting. You probably aren't fully through stats. This shows each one against its counterpart. So for example, Walmart against Walmart has a perfect correlation, 1.00. Here's my rule, and you can do, others will say different things. My rule is no more than 0.30, no more. So I look over here, Walmart and Meta, they would be great in a portfolio together because they're canceling out a lot. They're very poorly correlated at 0.12. Walmart against GM is great. Against Tesla. Against Pfizer. Now here's one right on the edge. Walmart against Apple. They're 0.30. That's right about, I mean, I don't even need to do that because I've got so many already. Walmart and against MasterCard. Walmart is actually one that would be good in any portfolio. That would be sort of what we call one of our keys for a portfolio. It would be a Walmart because it seems to be correlated with almost nothing. Now let's look at Meta. Now this is symmetric about the diagonal. So we'll go to Meta. We'll look at Meta against GM. It's not too bad. It's against Tesla, not bad. Oh, look at Meta against MasterCard, 0.36. Now, sometimes it's obvious why they're highly correlated, and other times it's like, WTF, what? You know, why? But here it is. They would not be good in a portfolio together because they're not doing as much as other stocks would do. Look at General Motors. Come over here. Well, obviously against Tesla, it's about 0.30. Pfizer, yeah. Now that one, why is General Motors have a nasty correlation with Apple? Who knows? But against Lockheed Martin, a defense industry company, low. But General Motors against MasterCard, I know why. General Motors credit. They are subject to exposure of risks in the same credit extending industry. That one, okay, I got it. Tesla against Pfizer, I mean, they're so, it's obvious, 0.06, yeah, sure. But against Apple, what? And against Lockheed Martin, oh, that's a nice, nice one. 0.01, MasterCard, 0.24, not bad. Okay, now going down here to Pfizer. Pfizer against Apple, decent. Now that one, Pfizer against Lockheed Martin. What, Lockheed Martin builds defense stuff and people get injured and Pfizer's medical stuff they give to them? I don't know. Against MasterCard, not bad. Apple against Lockheed Martin. Ooh, look at that. Apple against MasterCard, the hell? Oh, they both have credit facilities. Lockheed Martin against MasterCard. I got nothing. I got nothing on that. Nope. But do you see how this correlation matrix, and for one thing, I see right here, Walmart is a key component of a portfolio because it's insensitive against almost everything. And other ones that aren't too bad, Tesla, it's got a couple, that worries me. But I don't know. Meta, It's pretty good, too, against a lot of stuff except MasterCard. You can go down the list here, and you can see, and you can type in your own symbols, and before you decide to jump into a stock, look at how it's correlated against something you already have. Use this portfolio visualizer. It's just a great free tool. It's been around for a long, long, long time. And even my former students who are out there in the equities world, they'll go back to it and look at it when they're thinking of throwing in an investment. Because the last thing you want to do is put in two investments that feed each other's volatility. You want them to cancel out each other's volatility. And so you can get faster down to that, not your portfolio has nothing but non-diversifiable risk in it kind of thing. And you're never going to get there all the way. But I will tell you a couple of one little trick here along the way. And this is something that I usually reserve for my 242 class investments. Let me show you something here. I used to do this as part of the lectures, and anymore I don't. But I'll show it to you as a side hustle. This, you can do this on Google the word, the term that I'm going to show you, and you can see this over and over again. If we were going to draw risk, total risk, standard deviation, against expected return, against return, let's just do returns, to different stocks and portfolios. Now, this has been done so many times, it's ridiculous. And you'll see if you Google after I tell you the word. Let's take, Microsoft, its total risk and its return. Its risk as standard deviation or coefficient of variation, you could do. Take some other stocks with higher risk. Take some little portfolios and big portfolios. High risk, low risk. Now these scatter plots, as I said, they are the stuff of dissertations from long ago when we were still a little amazed at what we were seeing, taking higher risk. And the returns to different portfolios of stocks and bonds, little portfolios, big portfolios. And over, what happens is that we get scatter plots. And now with computers, they can do this in the blink of an eye. We see something emerge that comes from the world of physics and chemistry. Is it also in the world of kinesiology? It's in the world of engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering. It's a principle of the universe. No matter how many points we plot, there is a place where, on the other side of it, it's white space. We never see anything up in here. The term in mathematics for it and in engineering and physics is envelope. It's a performance envelope. We see it. You decide that you're going to become a beefy muscle builder. You know, you start playing the Rocky music every morning. Ba 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 ba. Any of you ever see the original Rocky movie? I saw it as a kid. I wanted to do that. Every morning he got up and he put 5 eggs in a glass and he drank them. Well, I thought I was going to do that. Now, that was the first time I did that. That was when I realized what the term debris field means. I mean, down it went and then up it came. But anyway, no matter how hard you try, there's a point of weight level you cannot cross. No matter what you do, you've hit your envelope. No matter how much you tweak your car, there is a speed that you cannot get above. No matter where we go in the universe, there is a size of a star that is the limit. We do not see one larger than that limit. No matter how much power you put into an engine, the speed of light is the barrier. You can't cross it. That's why we have to do tricks. We're working on these warp drives that can, technically they don't break the speed of light. They just kind of squeeze space in front and stretch it in back. But you see this envelope right here? We call it in finance the frontier of efficient investments. The frontier of efficient investments. It cannot be crossed. As a matter of fact, if you type in Google, frontier of efficient investments, images, you'll see pictures of this in odd, weird variations. But you'll see this over. Matter of fact, I made one myself, and it was on Google for years before it was replaced by more recent pictures of it. It's just, that's where the end is. Now, what would be on that frontier? Well, you see, what would be on it would be market portfolios. All of the stocks and bonds in the world in different combinations, but all of them, those would be market portfolios. It is a theoretical boundary. We can't reach it. The S&P 500 is near it, but it's not on it. So let me show you. Like, let's say this is Microsoft stock. It has that risk level, and it has that return. We should be able to get that return with a perfect portfolio right there. So in other words, this is all diversifiable risk. Only this part is beta risk. Because I could buy Microsoft, but there's also a portfolio that would get me the same return with less risk because I wouldn't have that diversifiable risk in it. Now, what does this mean? You can't, for example, now, okay, here's the one of the ways that you can get as close as possible. You get, it's called super portfolios. What you would do is you would get three very well-diversified portfolios. And you would put them together. And they would actually get you closer to the frontier. I mean, you're talking about in millimeters. But it actually is a portfolio management strategy. You don't just buy the spider. You grab the spider and another highly diversified ETF and another highly diversified ETF. You just put three of these together and they'll squeeze out a little more of that diversifiable risk. But even if you just got the S&P 500, you're pretty darn close to the frontier. You can't get there. It's a theoretical place. It's the envelope. It's that weight that you'll never achieve, but you can get closer and closer the more you're willing to get hernias. It's that speed. You can get closer and closer to it with your car, but you can never quite get to that dream speed in it. This is all in explosives. We can yield more and more thermal energy out of a bomb, a given chemical bomb, but there's a certain place where we can't get any more explosive power out of it. It's just the way the universe works. It sets limits on them and says, get closer to me. And that's what we do a lot of times in portfolio management, is we just get a couple of really well-diversified portfolios, and we put the damn things together. And the result of it is that we get the same expected return, but a little less of that standalone risk, as it were. It's one of the things we do. And like I said, there are a couple other... I'm reticent to use the word tricks. There are other ways that you can inch up to the frontier. One of them, believe it or not, is to mix T-bills in. And if you take me for 341, if you're that lucky, I'll even show you how you pull that stunt. It's pretty cool. But this is the introduction to finance that if before this you might have been a day trader, but here this is where you're looking inside, and now you're seeing the mechanics of the laws of physics and how they relate to what we do here in our subject. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.